The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
John Gibbons, so the good news first. How impressed are you by the announcement earlier this week by the Environmental Protection Agency that we managed to reduce our emissions by nearly 7% last year?
Yeah, good evening, Matt. It's certainly probably the first bit of good news we've had on emissions really this decade. We, as you know, we had a slight dip around COVID, but it bounced back fairly strongly. So this indicates that in certain areas, particularly in energy production, we're making some progress. But I think context is important. For example, we know that versus our 2005 levels, by now we're supposed to be, in line with our EU obligations, we're supposed to be about 42% below 2005. We're actually 10% below 2005. So in that sense, Matt, we're way, way off target. The second thing to say is that because we've done so little really over the first 4 years, 3 years, I suppose, of the 2020s, we've actually got to manage annual reductions every single year of over 8% for every year from 2024, 2025, all the way to the end of 2020. To 2030. And the thing to understand about these emissions cuts is that the deeper the cuts, the low-hanging cuts are the easy ones to manage. And we've managed some of those. But as we move up to the next 8% and the next 8%, you're getting into some really difficult territory here with difficult decisions that have to be made. So, of course, it's encouraging that at least in some areas, the rate of emissions increase has leveled off. For example, it's still rising in transport, but this time by less than 1%. A couple of other areas, it has come down slightly, but we're still miles away from the track that we need to be on. If you remember, Matt, we're supposed to be on a 51% trajectory
John,
by 2030. Yeah.
You see, I don't know what our population was in 2005. I hadn't expected you to bring up that year as a benchmark. But I would suspect that it could have been anything up to a million people fewer than we have in the country now. So if you have a million additional people and you have a much bigger economy, which much more people at work than ever before and greater output, that gives even further credit to what we've managed to achieve in reduction. That the figures that were set as ambitions were set with different population targets in mind.
I think you're right. I think part of the gap between that 10% I described versus 2005 versus the 40% we need to be at, part of that gap can indeed be explained by the fact that we've added more than a million citizens in that time. So that has definitely been a factor. But just remember as well, there's a whole bunch of areas where we really should be making dramatic progress. For example, cars had been improving in their efficiency, in their engine efficiency, all the way up to about 2010. But unfortunately, the switch to SUVs since 2010 has pretty much wiped out the gains that we were making. And it's even, as you know, even wiped out gains that we've made from adding EVs to the fleet. So that it's sort of like we take one step forward and we take one step back. And I guess the issue here really, and this is maybe the thing we all need to keep in mind, is these are not academic targets. These are the targets that Ireland and other EU countries and other countries around the world, these are science-based targets. These are the targets that tell us that we have to make in order to avoid catastrophic impacts from climate change that none of us can manage. So the issue here really is we have to figure out how to make these targets. And it's not sufficient to say, well, this baseline has changed or we've added this number of people. We have to manage and we should be making much more progress. But I will stress again, Matt, we have made progress.
Okay, but can I say something else to you, John? Would you give credit to the farmers? Because apparently a large chunk of the reduction is down to their work, the work that they've done, particularly when it comes to the use of fertilisers.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The agriculture sector is down about 4%, which is obviously encouraging. And as you say, Matt, most of that is directly attributable to reduction in fertilizer usage. It begs an interesting question. And by the way, that it also tracks a slight reduction in milk output because these things tend to be very closely aligned together. So that is encouraging. But it does beg the question, if farmers can manage to significantly reduce fertilizer use, and by the way, most of this was driven not by ecological reasoning, but by huge increases in fertilizer costs arising from the Ukraine war. But what that taught the farming sector, it appears, is that they're probably overusing chemical nitrogen and that we can in fact get by with a good deal less. And that's a positive message, by the way, for everybody. We know that we're overusing chemical nitrogen. We know that we've got a serious problem with water pollution arising from our overuse of nitrogen. So therefore, this is a welcome reduction. This is saving farmers money. This is reducing pollution. So that's one of those very rare win-wins, Matt. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to other things. Tell us about the fire at the world's biggest wetland and why that matters to us here in Ireland.
Yeah, this is a wetland that spans Brazil, Bolivia and Paraguay. It's known as the Pantanal. So I suppose most people, when you think of that part of the world, you think of the Amazon rainforest. So this is a vast wetland. In total, it covers about 16.9 million hectares, which is about 2.5 times the size of Ireland. So this is absolutely vast. So basically there is a fire season in the Pantanal every year, but it's usually in the late summer. What we've seen this year is the earliest ever fire season and the largest ever amount of area being burned. So far this year, they've lost about 760,000 hectares, which again is about 10% of the land mass of Ireland burned since the start of this year. So it's an incredible amount of burning.
Sorry, how and why is it burnt?
Well, first of all, the main reason for burning in the Pantanal, first of all, it's like a tinderbox, of course, because during the dry season, because of the elevated temperatures, it's much more prone to burning. But most of the burning that is happening, the vast majority of the so-called wildfires are started by ranchers who are using the fires as a method of land clearance to expand cattle herding in the Pantanal. So the issue really matters that most of the Pantanal is actually privately owned. So what you have basically are ranchers saying, well, you know, we're going to get rid of the wetlands. And as soon as the dry season hit, they start the fires, and it gives them a quick way again of converting wetlands into grasslands. Now, the reality, of course, is this is obviously from a climate point of view, from an ecological point of view, this is catastrophic. But it is a quick win for the individuals involved. And again, there's a lack of regulation. And of course, the problem is we in the West, we should be paying countries like Bolivia, like Paraguay, to actually protect their wetlands, to protect their rainforests, to place a value on them. But in the world that we live in, Matt, unless you put an economic value on something, right, like a forest, then if a forest is worth more dead than alive, if a wetland is, if we don't value areas like wetlands, well, then what happens is somebody locally will make the decision, well, actually, I've got an economic need and I'm going to do this. So this is the issue. This is the system that we're tied up with. But it does have, these have global consequences. These vast areas, as I said, between the Amazon rainforest and the Pantanal, I mean, these provide huge ecological services. They impact weather systems right across the world. So you could find thousands of kilometers away from South America altered weather systems as a result, and even potentially things like disastrous disruptions to the monsoon season as a result of the changes that are being wrought in the Pantanal region. It's also, of course, affecting humans. The local population are being severely affected by smoke inhalation. They found huge numbers of wild animals, monkeys, even jaguars found who have suffocated because of the smoke inhalation. So it's a regional catastrophe, but it also has a global overhang as well. Yeah.
One final one. Unless the Democrats grow a collective spine and get rid of Joe Biden as their candidate for the next presidential election, it looks almost certain that Donald Trump will get his hands back on the White House. If he does, what environmental issues would you expect him to address?
Well, first of all, it's going to be all bad. People will remember that when Trump got in 2017, one of the first things he did was he withdrew America from the Paris Agreement, and he also set about dismantling climate regulations in the US. Now, luckily, he was so inept, and his regime or his administration were so inexperienced that they really failed badly, and they were frequently beaten in the courts. Now, of course, since then, he has engineered a supermajority, as you know, in the Supreme Court. And for example, the Supreme Court recently pushed through a thing called the Chevron ruling, which effectively takes away expertise from agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and hands it to judges. And this, of course, suits Trump, because his big project, as you know, has been the politicization of the judicial system, which, of course, has also handed him a free hand, effectively, to be a dictator should he win in November. And I suppose from a climate point of view, Matt, the Project 2025, which has been cooked by the Heritage Foundation, one of these far-right think tanks, this basically has a plan to completely eviscerate all environmental regulations. They're planning to essentially get rid, they're planning to effectively hobble the Environmental Protection Agency and to remove many of its competences. And as you know, part of the Project 2025 is about essentially neutering the civil service, to remove the independent civil servants from across the administration in the US and replace them basically with party lackeys. So effectively to turn, I suppose, America 2025 into Germany sort of 1934. And unfortunately, from a climate point of view, what we're looking at here basically is America again falling away from its relative leadership position in global climate. Now, that isn't to say, by the way, Matt, that Joe Biden has been any great shakes, but the one thing he did do under his so-called Inflation Reduction Act, he smuggled in hundreds of billions of dollars worth of clean energy. And believe it or not, that has been extremely popular, even in Republican districts, because it has brought huge numbers of jobs in solar, in renewable energy, in battery technology. And Trump, for spite, will almost certainly unravel as many of these, even if it involves firing millions of American workers.
Thank you very much, John Gibbons, for joining us for our weekly Environment Spot.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.